More than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just three multinational agrochemical companies. In his book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply, today's guest, journalist Mark Shapiro, takes us to the front lines of the struggle for seed sovereignty in the face of unprecedented climate volatility and the consolidation of seed companies. What is being done to protect our food supply? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. 3 decades ago, today's guest, environmental journalist Mark Shapiro, was one of a small group of journalists writing about the impact of the narrowing genetic diversity in seeds. At the time, he did not anticipate the alarming forces that have rapidly dominated the seed market and have drastically changed our food system in the age of the climate crisis. Today, more than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just 3 multinationals. Mark Shapiro says one major result has been the accelerating disappearance of seed diversity. In his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply, Mark Shapiro details the impact of climate change and the consolidation of the seed market on our food system, the struggle over seeds with farmers, activists, and researchers fighting to bring back local control over seeds. Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist specializing in the environment. He is the author of 3 books, and he's lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And Mark joins me in studio. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you, Mark. I want to ask you before we dive in and talk about seeds, although it is related. You've been an environmental journalist for 30 years. And I wonder what you think of this new UN report that warns that 1 million plant and animal species could face extinction due to human activity. This was a 1,500-page study. This was a massive study. And it says, if we continue to destroy natural landscapes, so they're so specific, you know, population growth, these ag companies that are clearing all of this land, they say that they're doing this at rates unprecedented in human history.
Yeah, I mean, that report came out like a massive alarm going off about the traumatized state of the planet, really. And the report is really the first time. It's actually like the IPCC report about climate change, which was this panel of international scientists and came up with this scientific understanding of climate change. This report is the biodiversity equivalent of that level of science. And when they came out with that report, it is extremely unnerving. And what they're talking about is really a planet in deep, deep, deep disequilibrium. I mean, some years now, I've come to understand the ecological basis that enables the planet to function in a way that's friendly to humans, particularly, as well as many other species. And this latest report was truly an alarm going off about the rapid loss of species across the spectrum. And in a way, it really resonated with the book that I ended up writing, which is Seeds of Resistance, because you've seen the same process happening within the seed universe. Mm-hmm. Is this rapid diminishment of biological diversity. And that is happening at just the time that we need more diversity to deal with all the climatic stresses that are happening on the planet. So I think if we should see that as an alarm going off, in the same way that we saw some of the early IPCC reports about climate change as an alarm to the state of our planet.
So given that IPCC report about climate change that says we've got basically 12 years to really turn this around, here's another alarm. What do you think about the response? I mean, now that these are, huge alarms, okay, now what?
Well,
I mean, it's a huge question, but
yes.
And as someone who's been writing about this stuff for 30 years, do you think that the people who are in positions of power to implement the massive policy changes that we need will actually take some action on this?
Well, first of all, it depends which people, where, and what power. Mm-hmm. So obviously, at the national level, it's not even worth talking about. So basically, let's not talk about it.
With this administration.
Administration. Right. In terms of the White House, it's not worth spending our time on. But, I mean, it's worth it for many other reasons, but not right now.
Right.
So I think actually there are efforts around the world to actually try to protect the biodiversity that's left. And we could go into the many, many different responses, the scientific community, the political community, largely outside of the national level of the United States, is really coalescing around international treaties. There's a treaty called the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is intended to preserve biological diversity here on the planet. And so you have responses basically happening on many different levels, including right here in California, where there are efforts to actually preserve, for example, wetlands and different species-rich areas. So it depends what you are, what levels you are talking about. I think the level of consciousness is raising very highly to kind of political systems that can listen to this information. And as a journalist, this is one of the areas that we actually have to keep pursuing, because there are projects and efforts that continue to threaten biological diversity, and there are different ways of doing things that enhance biological diversity, which is what I wrote about in the food world in Seeds of Resistance.
Right. So before we dive in and talk about your book, The Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply, can you talk about why diversity of seeds is so important and what that means exactly? I feel like in many ways many people are still disconnected from their food, but when you really stop and think about it, and you just said you were spending some time in the Central Valley, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I took a trip to Big Sur a couple weekends ago, and I passed so many massive farms with farm workers, and this was on the weekend. And I just stopped and thought, you know, this is where so much of the food comes from,
yes.
At least here in the States, right in our backyard.
Yeah.
And thinking about the seeds in the ground and what it takes to create that strawberry, the lettuce. We've got melons coming now. I mean, we're changing seasons, so we have all these amazing fruits coming out.
Yes.
So can you just talk about diversity, seed diversity, and why that is so important?
Well, seed diversity is important for a number of huge reasons in a way. You know, I started writing this book as a kind of investigation into these three seed companies, and I ended up writing a book about biodiversity. Mm-hmm. With an investigation, and as doing this kind of journalism, I've actually begun to actually have a sense of ecological patterns in ways that I didn't have before. I think I'm learning a lot more about the Earth as an organism. And when you think of it as an organism, as this one huge organism with various gases balancing in the atmosphere, with different species related to one another, one after another, one after another, the links between all of us are actually more and more clear the more you understand about the Earth. And so the importance of biodiversity, what's happening is there are two things that are happening. One is that biodiversity is important to ensure the long-term health of our food system. So what's been happening is on the one hand, we've had a dramatic narrowing of biodiversity through the corporate consolidation of the seed industry. And on the other hand, you have climatic changes that are profoundly changing the conditions for growing food. So let me give you an example. And you mentioned, you know, I was just in the Central Valley doing a story for Bay Nature magazine, which is going to come out in the summer, about the impacts of climate change in the Central Valley. And what's happening there is that the industrial seed system relies on a set of predictable conditions. Because it's those predictable conditions, you can create these massive seeds that can be planted across massive areas of land. But the one thing you need are chemicals to keep them boosted to what they don't have in their integral. Genetics are boosted by chemicals, but the conditions which those were bred for are completely changing. And what we're seeing is higher and higher and higher levels of volatility, record-breaking heat, record-breaking rains that come at freakish times. And so it's that unpredictability that's really challenging this industrial system. And I saw that over and over and over again in the Central Valley, where even almond orchards that were planted, a lot of them have been planted over the last couple of years, are bit by bit by bit, and it depends where you are in the valley and what part of the valley, are being upended because they can no longer be sustained. There's not enough water. if people have had to drill deep, there's too much salt in the water. So there's this slowly brewing crisis actually emerging in the Central Valley, and which has to do with water, not enough of it, salt, too much of it, and in some cases, freakish rain that comes at the wrong time in the growing season.
Wow.
And to respond to those conditions, you need a diversity of seed varieties that are able to actually be much more resilient to these changes than these kind of brittle varieties that come from the big
companies. So given that there's so much unpredictability, is it safe to say that this is the case throughout many parts of California, not just the Central Valley?
Well, this is the case throughout the world.
Right.
This is the case throughout the world.
But we're talking, what's amazing, though, about California, and it's always so interesting just to think about this. So, for example, the Central Valley is 450 miles long, and you just think about how much food is grown there. So much food. So much of everyday people rely on that part of the country for their everyday food. If there's so much unpredictability, what are you hearing from the farmers there? How are they dealing with this?
Well, I'm hearing a number of things. One, it's becoming much more challenging for tree farmers. To some degree, row crop farmers can change their crops from year to year to have more heat-resistant crops. To some degree, that's possible. But when it comes to trees, trees get planted for 25 years.
Wow.
30 years. And so you
plant an almond tree?
Yeah, an almond tree is a 25-year, as basically a 25-year lifespan. So if you plant a tree today, the conditions in which it's growing over the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years are going to be dramatically different than they are today. Mm-hmm. So how do you anticipate what kind of tree you're going to grow? And there's all sorts of incredible research being done in the Valley about these kind of questions. And so you get extremely high uncertainty about what these Central Valley farmers are facing. And at the same time, they're facing a drops in their access to the water aquifer because the water's been depleted in the aquifer and a new law is coming into shape that's going to restrict their access to the aquifer.
For the first time ever.
For the first time ever. Yeah.
Yeah. Do these farmers acknowledge climate change and how it's affecting their everyday practices? So I'm sure some of them do, some of them don't.
I would say, I realized as a journalist that I tried to engage farmers on this question, and they would – not all of them would call – use the two words climate change. The one word they use is change. Change. Mm-hmm. Change, and over and over and over again was the sense. You can call whatever you want. You come up with anything you want, you can call it God. You can call it bad luck. You can call it fate. You can call it fortune, whatever you want to call it, basically. But things are changing in ways that I have never seen. I'm speaking – how people have spoken to me in ways that they had never seen, and their fathers, many of them are still family farms, even though they're very large family farms. Their fathers, even grandfathers and grandmothers, grandparents had never seen before. So the changes are extremely dramatic. They don't necessarily call it climate change, but the younger generation is.
Right. Well, and so speaking of change, you spoke with George Frisvold.
Oh, yeah.
An agricultural resource economist at the University of Arizona, and he described the shifting boundaries not only in California but across the country. He said, he told you, Ohio will look like Kentucky, Kentucky will look like Tennessee, Tennessee will look like Alabama, Central California will look like Arizona. Conditions that have long reigned in the forbiddingly dry northern Mexican state of Sonora are coming to Arizona and New Mexico. I mean, he just went on and on and on. He talked about some of the richest agricultural areas of the planet, South Africa, Australia, and Southwest China, can now look to Arizona for a glimpse into their own future.
Yes, and that's was pretty sobering. I traveled to Arizona in the course of doing this book, and I was really struck at how Arizona is really the bullseye on climate change, the climate impacts, because on the one hand, there is a substantial industrial agriculture scene there. They grow a lot of peppers, they grow a lot of lettuce, melons on a mass scale. totally reliant on chemicals because you could smell them as you're approaching Yuma County, where a lot of this is centered. And what's happening is that number one, the temperature is changing profoundly. The temperature is going up. The water supply is going down. What's also happening, new pests and diseases are moving into Arizona that used to be limited to Mexico, that used to be limited to Central America and Mexico, are moving north. They're following the heat. And I had a I went to Arizona, and I saw that happening. And I want to tell you a story, an amazing story about the Midwest of America also. And I've spent time in the Midwest in reporting this book. And you have in Kansas, I'll tell you, this is Kansas, the Midwest of America, is becoming more like the Mideast. Why can I say that? It's a very radical thing I feel like to say. But the Midwest is becoming like the Mideast. And here's where you begin to see, this is where you begin to see the evidence. And it's that it's the agricultural world that gives us these signs. So the huge wheat fields of Kansas, Nebraska, the wheat center of America, have been hit over the past decade, really, at an accelerated level by a new pest. The pest is called the Hessian fruit fly. And that fly basically lodges itself in wheat leaves. Traditionally, they've been killed off by the onset of winter. Cold-blooded animal, insect, killed off, onset of winter. The problem is that the winter's coming later now in Kansas, and so the larvae are hatching and devouring wheat leaves, decimating huge parts of the wheat crop. 10 to 15% of yield drop due to this one pest. And so in a panic, a lot of the wheat growers and the wheat research institutions, particularly around Kansas State University, which does a lot of work in this area, was trying to figure out how do we respond to this pest. You couldn't keep applying more and more and more and more pesticides. That's always an option, but it's very dangerous. And so they did a test, and they went out and they found all the kind of wheat seedlings they could possibly find that could grow in the Midwest. And they grew them up to about 3 inches high, and then they unleashed a horde of Hessian fruit flies into the hothouse and saw which one survived. And the one that survived was the wheat seed that came from Syria. And it's an incredible story about how, of course, Syria is in the middle of the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent, the old ancient Mesopotamia, you remember from your old geography lessons, was the seat of domesticated agriculture. And the seeds themselves have an amazingly dramatic story because they were stored at a seed bank outside of Aleppo. And when Assad started bombing Aleppo, a whole troop of scientists moved the seeds, raced the seeds across the border into Lebanon, which is where they are now. And they are being used now in Kansas to actually breed resistance to the Hessian fruit fly because they're the one seed variety that was capable of doing that without chemicals. And so what's interesting, that's an interesting story. It's a way to actually understand the importance of biological diversity in the seed realm. We need to have all these varieties to choose from to see where those particular characteristics are and use them to enable us to have some levels of resilience.
And how was that relationship created between Syria and, did you say Kansas?
Yeah.
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 How did that happen?
That was through, that preceded, by the way, the war. So over years, you know, agronomists, this whole world of agronomists and seed scientists and botanists, they're all exchanging information. The United Nations has a set of, has a number of seed banks in different parts of the world that are set in particular ecological zones. So this seed bank was called, is called the International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas. And I mentioned that long term, we'll call it ICARDA, International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas. More and more important because more and more of the planet is becoming a dry area. And it was that seed bank that had exchanges going with the Kansas City University people and through which they got access to those seeds.
Today we're speaking with Mark Shapiro, an award-winning investigative journalist specializing in the environment. He has been covering these issues for 3 decades. He's the author of 3 books. His latest is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And if you have any questions for Mark about seeds and about agriculture, he just got back from the Central Valley. He's going to have a piece out in The Great Magazine, which I'm so glad Bay Nature is still thriving because they do such good work, about what's happening in the Central Valley. As he said, there's a lot of unpredictability there and really around the globe. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Mark, before we talk about the 3 big multinationals that own half of the global seed market, since your book is called Seeds of Resistance, and last time you were on, you shared a lot of stories of resistance. Can we just maybe talk about that first? I just feel like there's so much of the news is pretty daunting right now. And there are so many small-scale farmers that are fighting back. And not only do they have these multinationals trying to get in to their communities, but their governments are just opening the door to companies like Monsanto and DuPont and saying, sure, for the right price, come on in. And like even the Obama administration had this plan in Africa that said you have to use these seeds. So let's talk about how people are resisting that.
Okay, well, let's start with
like, what story do you love? What story really gives you hope when we're talking about these issues?
I think a number of different stories. First of all, let's just starting overseas for half a second, is yes, the effort was by the big seed companies and the Obama. I'm sorry, the seed question has been kind of somewhat bipartisan. Mm-hmm. But there has been a whole movement, African seed sovereignty movement in Africa, which has really protested every step of the way when their governments have attempted to put into place plant patenting laws, which would put under patent protection seeds that have evolved in thousands of years in Africa. There's a big battle actually going on right now. So I find that pretty interesting because it's showing it's actually slowing the efforts to impose those kind of laws. And closer to home, there are many, and I write in the book about many different seed-saving enterprises, the huge growth of the Organic Seed mm-hmm. Alliance, which is because there's been a growth in organic food in the United States as a result of a growth in organic seeds. And to tell you one story, which I really found very moving in Arizona, is I went down and I met with one of the top researchers into agriculture in dry areas. This guy, Gary Nabhan, and he has an experimental farm about 20 miles north of the border. He's been working a lot with Native American people mm-hmm. in Arizona and throughout the Southwest to actually work on seeds that actually will be resilient to the changing temperatures. And there's been this growing recognition extremely belatedly, but nevertheless is happening essentially now to the practices of Native American farmers who have been around for several thousand years and have figured out how to grow food in extremely different circumstances. And so I think there's been a growing recognition among people in the not only in the Southwest, but I witnessed it vividly in the Southwest to working with Native American people on their approach to growing food. And there's a lot we could learn. Mm.
Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll find out more about that. Mark Shapiro is an award-winning environmental journalist. He's been covering these issues for 30 years, and his latest book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. Every Monday, we spend the hour talking about crucial issues affecting our planet. We talk about the climate crisis. We talk about plastic, lobster wars. Today, we are speaking with Mark Shapiro, award-winning investigative journalist, about his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. He reports that more than half of all commercially traded seeds have fallen under the control of just three multinational agrochemical companies, but as he reports, a number of small farmers, activists, and researchers are fighting to bring back local control over seeds. And if you have a question or a comment for Mark, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Mark has been covering the environment for 30 years, so he has a good grasp on what we are currently facing. And let's hear from Ruth Ann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show. Oh, do we have Ruth Ann?
Can you hear me?
Hi, there you are. Hi, Ruth Ann.
I wanted to ask Mark Shapiro, he was addressing the three big, huge seed companies nationally, what his thoughts were on movements to grow locally, seeds and produce and fruit, as a response to the monopolization of the seeds by the big companies.
Well, that's an excellent question, and the importance of growing food locally is number one. It's important on a number of different levels. Number one, it's just important that we as people, and I'm sure you sense this, maybe it's the genesis of your question, the importance of feeling this connection to our food supply is important, and the closer we are to our food supply, the more appreciation we're going to have for how that food is grown and who grows it. That is totally key. The second part of the picture is that it turns out that seeds that have actually evolved in a particular set of conditions are much more able to respond to change, what I call actually environmental trauma, whether it's a heat wave, a freakish rainstorm, a drought. It's shown over and over and over again, and I have a lot of the scientific backup here in my book. I've poured through all the studies, and over and over and over again, we're actually learning that actually it's this biological diversity. It's the ability of seeds that have evolved in a particular set of conditions to respond to changes in those conditions, because it gets us back down to Darwin. It's basically very simple when you think about it. It's basically those seeds that will survive, or there will be seeds that will die, but then there will be those that survive, and those are the ones that you want to continue utilizing. And you can see that very vividly in agriculture. And what's interesting is I've talked about even a lot of studies, even by big Midwestern institutions as well as those in California and elsewhere, over and over and over again, they talk about how the narrowing of diversity is endangering the stability of the American food system.
Hmm.
And even the USDA under Obama, remember the previous, our previous government, came up with a set of recommendations that was about broadening the genetic base in order to be able to respond to climatic stress. So there are two answers to your question, both local and global.
Well, and speaking of local, you write about this in your book, that there are hundreds of seed libraries throughout the country. There are about a half a dozen here in the Bay Area. And so people can actually check out the seeds, plant them, and then return new seeds after they harvest?
Yeah, these are like totally cool. I went to a couple of these libraries. I didn't know they were out there. And then suddenly there's a fantastic one here in Richmond, just around the corner from here, which is in the main public library in Richmond. You go to a little part of the library, and there are all these seeds, which actually are in the old And I saw the same thing in Tucson and other places, where when libraries went digital, they had all those cool card catalogs. People of my generation remember these old card catalogs. You'd pick up the little index cards. You too, Rose.
I loved those.
Much better. You know, just something more intimate than the computer screen thing. Anyway, so they put all those in the back room, didn't know what to do with all those cool cards. And now they're coming back, and they're loading them up with seeds. And that's what you'll find if you go to Richmond. If you happen to be in Tucson, there's one like that, and there's one strung all over the country of people who are saving their local seeds, planting them out, and then returning them with little comments as to how they did in particular circumstances.
Mm, I love that. Yeah. And do you know, are people taking advantage of that?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
is
yeah.
Is it popular?
Oh, yeah, no, it's more popular. Yes, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It's and these kind of seed exchanges that are happening all over the country. There's one up in Santa Rosa that happens every year. There's one in the middle of Iowa, in Decorah, Iowa, called the Seed Exchange. If people want to look it up, it's seedexchange.com, something like that. And there's ones in the east, on the East Coast, in the Hudson Valley. It's ecological zones, which then feature the seeds within those zones. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was lost from when the corporate consolidation began happening in the began really 30 years ago and has been steadily happening since is when the big companies bought smaller seed companies and largely took those locally bred seeds out of commission. They took them off the market and replaced them with these kind of big blockbuster seeds. And that's where we've been that's one of the reasons we've been losing seed varieties. I have to say the flip side of that is that there have been pushback. There are these kind of small seed companies emerging all over the country that are beginning to kind of resist this trend.
Well, thank you for the call, Ruthann. You can give us a call and ask Mark Shapiro a question about seeds, about the importance of biodiversity. Mark is an award-winning investigative journalist, and his latest book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And Judy from San Francisco just called to let us know that there are two seed libraries here in San Francisco, one in the Portola Branch Library and another in Potrero. Thank you for that, Judy. And if you'd like to call and give a shout out to your local seed bank, we'd love to hear from you. In fact, our connection's a little slow, so calling might be better. 866-798-8255. Okay, Mark, now we do have to talk about the three multinationals that own half of the global seed market. And it's so interesting because I thought at first, did I misspell this, Dow DuPont? But no, because they merged. Same with Bayer Monsanto, they merged, and Syngenta. So these are three companies. They used to be five. So now it's Dow DuPont, Bayer Monsanto, and Syngenta. So before we talk about their role with seeds, I mean, these were massive mergers. Can you talk about the significance of these huge multinational ag companies coming together and what that means?
Yes. Well, these are kind of massive. Yes, they each individually was already massive.
Right.
I think Bayer was the top, either the top one or two chemical company in Germany before it took over Monsanto, which was the number one seed company in America. Dow and DuPont would go back and forth, number one, number two, when it came to the production of chemicals, of agricultural chemicals. And so this has actually been part of a overall sort of consolidation of control over the agricultural, in the agricultural realm. And the third company, I'll tell you what's particularly unique and what I think is particularly something we should be aware of and concerned about the implications of these mergers. So first of all, we got Bayer Monsanto. We have Dow DuPont, which, by the way, spun off now has a seed division owned by the Dow DuPont merge company called Corteva. But don't be surprised by the kind of friendly nature of a Corteva, whatever. That probably was a focus grouped name. Corteva is the formal name of the seed company owned by Dow DuPont. And the third company is Syngenta, which is owned by the company ChemChina, which is the biggest chemical company in China. And Syngenta was the biggest seed company in Switzerland and really in Europe. So these three companies came together. They now control more than 50% of all seeds. Why does that matter? So it matters for two reasons. One is these companies produce seeds that are born dependent on their chemicals. So they produce the seeds, and then they produce the chemicals to keep the seeds alive. I call these crack baby seeds. Mm. They're born addicted to chemicals. They can't survive without the mother company's own chemicals. So they come out of their out of the sack and into the field, totally dependent on chemicals. And I think that raises all sorts of public health and ecological concerns about the linkage of a seed to a precise set of chemicals at the outset of its from its moment in the soil. And the second thing of great concern about that is that those seeds are also extremely brittle. Because they're so dependent on chemicals, they've been found over and over and over again. It's just science is backing this up, extremely brittle to changing conditions. And so at just the moment you have this extreme consolidation, you have, one, the public health consequences of dependency on chemicals, and the other hand, the essential brittleness of a seed population that's unable to kind of respond to the changing conditions. And that's essentially one of the things that drove me to write this book was actually to see these converging forces, concentration on the one hand, climate change on the other, happening at the same time.
Mm. And can you talk about, I mean, what happens when these corporations go into, say, poor countries, for example, and then corrupt governments just open the door to these companies and make the farmers use these seeds, which, as you say, are dependent on chemicals, which then has an effect not only on the food, but on the soil and the future health of the farm and the farmers.
Yeah, this basically has happened over and over and over again, repeatedly, and which is that largely as a result of American pressure, laws are written to facilitate the entry of American, it's not just American, actually. It's American or the Swiss-Chinese combine or, let's say, Western seeds. Although China complicates things. Western, Eastern seeds. Mm. This is, you know, it's complicated. But large industrial seed companies to enter into foreign markets. And often those seeds are provided at a kind of a discounted level. This is kind of the pattern that we see over and over again. At a discounted level in the first year or two. So they're disseminated to farmers at some discounted level. And farmers respond. And sometimes they actually perform. And then what happens is that the subsidies run out. Farmers are forced to keep buying the pesticides and the herbicides and the nematicides that kill off the pests. They become more and more and more expensive, and they start showing more and more higher levels of resistance, as insects will do. And weeds are now showing resistance to herbicides. And the yields start to plummet, but meanwhile, the indigenous seeds have been lost. Mm. And so there are efforts all around. I've talked to people in Tunisia. I've talked to people in Zambia, in South Africa, very lively efforts to actually preserve local seed varieties for precisely this reason, because they're afraid they've been losing them through this process.
Mm. And a lot of this has to do with American strong-arming, right?
Yes.
But in many cases, the government goes along with it and in some cases allows Monsanto and some of these other companies to actually write the new rules.
Yes. Yeah. That has been happening a lot, where the U.S. government, operating in close concert with the seed companies, particularly Monsanto, has been working very, very hard to introduce GMOs into southern Africa, both South Africa and other southern African countries, which has raised a real battle, which is actually going on right now, over how much they're going to allow GMOs into those countries. And that is done largely through the sort of company influence mixed with the influence of the U.S. government putting pressure. A big scandal erupted in Tunisia about a year ago when it was found out that the person slated to become the president of Tunisia had actually worked as a Monsanto consultant in years prior, and is still busily opening up the country to these seeds. And this is, in a sense, a kind of a legacy of the Green Revolution of 60 years ago.
Right. And it just continues under this administration with Monsanto executives working within the administration, which has happened also under Democratic administrations. But what would you say is the difference with this particular administration when it comes to this issue?
I think when it comes to this issue, the difference is this, because I hate basically there has not been that much of a difference in the sense of how the White House approaches this question of corporate consolidation and the profusion of these industrial seeds or GMO seeds. The difference is that in the Obama administration, there were actual efforts to do deeper research and do some level of promotion of more organic kind of agriculture. And you saw that. There were all these research programs opening up at the USDA, had a whole branch of organic research that was moving forward. And there was a lot of important advances done within a couple of years within the USDA, which is and I think those efforts have been dramatically shrunk in this current administration. Mm.
Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist. He's been writing about environmental issues for 30 years. He's author of Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I've purchased the book, and it's really a great read. Could you comment, please, on the ability of the organic plants? I'm thinking specifically of the cotton in the San Joaquin Valley, to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, as opposed to the inability of the monoculture crops, the GMO crops, to do the same?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you, sir. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. It's a very good question in this regard, which is, I think, the difference, I think you're talking about GMOs versus other crops' ability to absorb carbon. And the key thing there is the planting of cover crops. So it's not so much exactly the seed, the nature of the seed itself, that's going to determine how much carbon is absorbed. What is going to determine the carbon absorption potential are two factors. One is the planting of cover crops, which are crops that actually enrich the soil and deliver nutrients back into the soil and cycle nutrients through the soil and absorb carbon while they're doing that, which is very important. And two, whether or not those farmers use tilling techniques. So there's been a whole move now to actually begin to try to reduce the tilling of fields, because it's the till. When you go in there and you chop up all that kind of soil and then you bring it back up to the surface after each season, you're actually releasing carbon. And by actually utilizing compost and those kind of measures to actually let compost and other organic material rest in the soil, one, you're enriching the soil itself, and two, you're absorbing more carbon. So those are the two factors to keep an eye out for when it comes to CO2 absorption.
Well, thank you so much.
And not just CO2, sorry, it's carbon. It's several greenhouse gases come out of agriculture, including nitrogen. Yeah.
Thank you for the question, Mark. We don't have that much time left. Oh, we're almost out of time, actually. But what else do you think we need to know about these three multinational companies that own over half of the seed supply? What is their plan for the next couple of years, say 5-10 years, given that climate change, the climate crisis has become so intense? Are they going to continue business as usual?
Well, they are, for them, what is business as usual? The I was just at this conference a couple of weeks ago of the tech community waking up to the climatic disruptions affecting agriculture, and all three of these companies were present, and their interest now is not only in continuing to kind of do the breeding in concert with their chemical production, but also to move into the genome itself of the plant to actually try to develop new characteristics within the genome using very sophisticated genetic technology. So I think they're going from starting to move into the genome, which is what's happening. Yes.
Well, I'd love to have you back to talk specifically about the end game for these companies. We need to really follow the money, find out how close they're working with the administration. I mean, their profits are massive. Yeah. But we have one last question. Ron, we can't get to you, but I will ask Mark your question. He wanted to ask you about the bioaccumulation of toxins and additives to food products. And I'm thinking he means the chemicals that are sprayed on these foods and how they end up on the food itself, the plants, and then how they end up on the food.
Yeah, well, you have, there are all sorts of, my first book years ago was called Circle of Poison. I co-authored that book, and it was about the residues of toxic pesticides that are remain on food. And if you're getting food that's non-organic, the chances are that it has residues on it, which is why you're supposed to wash your food. And there's actually interesting more and more research I've come upon that indicates that organically grown food has far more nutritional value. There are certain minerals and certain antioxidants that seem to be higher quantity in organically grown food than in conventional chemical food.
Yeah, and also the studies show that if you stop eating, like, say, a strawberry that's doused with 80 chemicals, those they actually leave your body pretty quickly, but they can have long-term effects.
Yes.
So it's really tricky. But we did actually have the Environmental Working Group on about a month ago to talk about their Dirty Dozen and their Clean Dozen, which is a great resource. Mark Shapiro is an award-winning investigative journalist. His latest book is Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Mark, thanks for your work. As always, we'll definitely have you back. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls One Planet series.